You're listening to Beyond 1894, a podcast dedicated to updating you on research, innovation, and campus life happening at Louisiana Tech University.
Hey, y'all, and welcome to Beyond 1894. It's the Louisiana Tech University podcast, and today we are joined by Dr. Patrick Scott, who is a professor of economics. At our College of Business at Louisiana Tech. So thanks, Dr. Scott, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So we were talking before we started the actual recording of the podcast, and I asked you, why economics?
Yeah, okay, so that's kind of a loaded question. I didn't start out with an economics, and I would probably argue that the vast majority of students in economics don't actually start with economics. I actually started, most freshmen end up changing their major at least once, but I did too. I was actually a dual major, music performance and music business. So it's kind of perfectly out of left field there. And there's some back history as to kind of my history with music there, but within part of that, that music business curriculum, I had to then take an economics class and absolutely fell in love with it. And it's amazing that the thing that I always ended up gravitating towards within any of the work with bands that I did or works with studios and things like that at the time as a musician, I gravitated toward the business side of things. I gravitated towards the kind of nuts and bolts of the decision-making process. So when I took, at the time, Principles of Micro, it completely clicked to me. It made sense to me. And at the same time, was really struggling with the music performance aspect of it because I absolutely hated the music director that I was working under. And so it was this perfect storm of, yeah, I'm ready for a change. But it was good because it kind of opened me up to different aspects of the process that I normally wouldn't have pushed myself to. If you had told me, hey, you're going to go into economics, I would have laughed at you. It's a nonlinear path.
So you mentioned music performance. What did you play?
Yeah, percussion, drums. And so I picked up a pair of sticks when I was 12 and played in all kinds of musical situations, various groups all throughout my teen years. I spent more time outside of class as a senior in high school than I was in class because I was touring with various groups around the eastern side of the country. I still don't know how I graduated. Afterwards, I of course, had overly ambitious dreams of being a professional musician, and as most teenagers tend to do, and it's okay. But I started doing a lot of work with various studios as a session player, and so we'd kind of come in, learn something real quick, lay down a track, get out. Eventually, I got hungry and decided that I needed to do something different. And so about 4 years down the road, when I was 22, that's actually when I went to college. So I took some time off then, which was good. I mean, I grew up. That's always good. I knew I wasn't ready for college at the time, so I would have made a whole cascade, I'm sure, of terribly bad decisions.
so you were not a traditional aged student?
That's correct,
then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was not traditional in that regard. Started college at 22, crammed a four-year college degree into five, but went directly into a terminal PhD program. So I didn't graduate with my PhD until 32. So, yeah.
Well, but you found the path that you're supposed to be on.
Yeah. Well, for me, I don't necessarily think that there's one path that you're quote unquote supposed to be on. I feel like that's a little too pigeonholed, but rather there are things that you can do and are good at. And that this ends up being the thing that I'm the most comfortable with. But I would not have thought it as me as a teenager. No, no way. No way.
So do you still play?
I don't, oddly enough. And there's something that I've slowly just kind of come to terms with. I played relatively less course in graduate studies because, well, you're busy.
You don't have time.
You don't have time. You're doing everything that you're told. And so I played relatively less. I did pick up and try to play with a handful of different groups kind of on and off after I graduated. But it just kind of was less important to me. I was willing to make less sacrifices for it that ultimately just decided, yeah, I'm ready to move on. And just recently, in the past couple of years, sold my kit. My last kit, I actually had four. I had a bit of a problem. Anyway, there's that whole eating thing we're talking about. But finally get rid of all of those. And I'm at peace with it. I'm okay with it. I still have my symbol collection because I had kind of collected some old vintage and antique symbols. And I still have those because I can't part with the symbol that was made in the early 1900s and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
It's an investment.
Yeah, I figure eventually I'm going to find some musician that's willing to take care of them the way that I have, and mm-hmm. then I'll just basically endow them to someone eventually when the time's right.
Do you have a gong?
I don't have a gong. No, I've never had a gong. No, I never was in big in the 80s, yeah, I get that, but no, never had a gong. That's one thing I could have done. Could do the whole stick twirling thing, yeah, that part I had, but yeah, the gong, no.
Oh, so we were talking also earlier about the creativity in economics that is possible. You know, I think that lots of us, and by us I mean people who don't have business degrees, frame econ as something that has to be horribly cerebral and not fun and not something that you can get creative. But you mentioned the creativity that's possible in working. So tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So it's not, it seems very dry to the casual observer. And in some ways, yeah, I can see how some portions of it are dry because, and as an undergrad, I kind of found anything related to economics interesting. As I went on through graduate studies and then eventually kind of honed what I was going to research on, I find less portions of economics interesting. There are some things that I just fundamentally not enjoyable to me in any way, shape, or form. That's okay. But it does take an incredible amount of creativity to see the various connections from the small little microcosms of literature that people have done and then find unique ways to kind of lace them together. And that's where you kind of have to take a step back from it a little bit, and that may be kind of why people don't necessarily associate it with the creative process, because most creative processes are kind of taught to kind of be inherently in tune with how you feel almost as you're doing that. In that regard, yeah, economics is definitely devoid of that. But to me, there is still a lot of creativity attached to that. And in some ways, as you have a limited toolbox, that limiting toolbox kind of helps you get more creative in how you use those tools to get to your end result. In a lot of ways, that's kind of how research goes. You end up finding a small little group of papers that assumes X, Y, and Z, and then you realize, okay, over here, this group of papers don't necessarily assume that, so then how do I lace them together? How do I then examine the intersection between these two groups? And so, in that regard, yeah, there's a good deal of creativity attached to that in order to be able to see how the equations work together. For me, 9 times out of 10, I can set up a model and I know what the math will look like before I solve it. But most people, that's very difficult for them to see. And I can see why then that kind of seems a little nebulous and not so creative. Definitely my high school version of me would not have understood that at all because, I mean, I was asleep in high school math. I had to relearn all of it when I went to college.
Well, we also talked about, and I thought that this was interesting, you talked about students and inspiring students to kind of take control of their own learning processes. And I know that this is something that happens in college. I mean, we're not capable of really doing that as young learners, and by young, I mean elementary school, middle sure. school. You start becoming a more self-driven learner mm-hmm. as you get older. And you use the phrase, our students are not vessels.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
I'll kind of backfill that a little bit because I think it kind of might be helpful. Because I taught an FYE class a few years ago, and one of the things I tried to impress upon those students in our very first meeting was that college is fundamentally different than primary education. And the reason, part of it has to do with that process that you talk about, how students, they're not able to think deeply yet when they're first learning about a concept. But at the same time, you also, it's almost endogenous how we have, our teachers are different fundamentally between primary education and college or secondary. Within a primary education role, those teachers are taught pedagogy. They're taught how to teach, but they're not masters of what they teach. They may be good at a particular topic or subject. So you can get some type of comparative advantage from that. But at the end of the day, the teachers teaching in our high schools across the country, they're not necessarily, in some cases they are, but in most cases, they're not experts in their field. Then you come to college, and those college professors, they're drastically different. They're not taught methods of pedagogy. They're not taught how to teach. They stumble through that, and some fail catastrophically at it, too. but they're masters of what they know, and that's why they're hired. They're hired because of their expertise. So that's why when you have a college professor that simultaneously is good at communicating and also knows what they're teaching, they leave such an amazing impact on a student because they're able to speak the language as well as know that material and make those connections. So yeah, so there's that kind of component of it as well that's kind of drastically important. But within my project-based classes, my research methods class and my regional class, those classes they have to be student-driven. Students have to take those topics and have to take ownership of those topics because in that case, they end up getting the most out of the experience from that. They can't think critically about something that they are just now learning. They have to be the ones to engage that process a little more actively so that they can deeply learn it the quickest way possible. And we only really deeply learn something when we're interested in learning it.
So you touched on it a little bit. For the past couple of years, I think, the Real Report has been coming out. Tell me about the Real Report.
So the Real Report is basically kind of an incarnation or reincarnation, if you will, of the efforts of the Center for Economic Research. And this center, unfortunately, kind of fell into disuse purely by accident at the Cobb, only because the person that was leading those efforts passed away right as I was starting. So John Francis was leading that earlier on a few years back, and he actually interviewed me. He was on the hiring committee when I was being considered for the position here, and I basically got to work with him for 2 weeks, and then he died from cancer. And at the time, the center basically, there was no one else to lead it, and so it kind of fell into a little bit of disuse. And so through some conversations with Dr. Martin, the Dean of the Cobb, we kind of resurrected it, but we wanted to make it so that it wasn't just beholden to funding issues. We wanted to kind of tie it into the curriculum as well. So we created this class, and it's kind of like the anti-class. there are no lectures in this class, but really there's just a series of projects. And so it's a one-credit hour class, and students are they take it three quarters in a row to kind of turn it into a three-credit hour class. And in that class, they take some portion of the economy, or whether it's purely local here to Tech or whether it's something broader to Lincoln Parish or Northeast Louisiana or North Central or even the whole state in general, and then kind of dig deeper into that and find some aspect of it to learn and to learn deeply. And so in that regard, I don't define what students teach in that class, but I also don't let them fail in that regard too. If they don't find a topic that they can write on, I'll make sure they have something to write on. the report's kind of put out every single quarter. Leanne over there at the Cobb is just great for helping kind of polish it up at the end and get it ready for prime time, so to speak. But it's been a fun endeavor. It's something that I didn't anticipate doing. In fact, if I even starting here at Tech, I never would have thought that I would have led a class like this. So, I mean, it's called Regional Economic Analysis, and I called it economic analysis afterwards, basically because it's not a pure regional econ class. So it's in some aspects it looks like it, but in some aspects it has a broader scope than that. So sometimes we'll talk about highly localized things like the expansion of the new women's athletic facilities or the rebuilding of the soccer or the baseball stadium. Or sometimes we'll look at much broader things like employment reports, or some firm is looking at expanding here. Amazon is looking to build a new distribution facility. What's that going to do? Things like that. So we kind of have a very wide net that we capture here, but then real quickly drill down deeply into it. And it's a lot of fun. I've really, really enjoyed it. So this is now the second year of the report. And so I'm excited.
It is from a communications perspective, it's really interesting to pitch stories that come out of, and by pitch, I mean talk to reporters about why they should do stories.
Sure.
Why they should work on those stories.
One of the things that we're going to be doing starting this next year also, and I'll kind of give you a tease of it, is we're going to be producing an annual report as well. And this is purely going to be more kind of the state of the state kind of report. So it's basically looking at large scale macro indicators, what's happening within the state, employment numbers, all of that. So it's going to be much broader too. But it's not necessarily digging at one particular pocket of the state. Louisiana is really odd economy. And it's odd in an economy in ways that are distinctly different from other states. Every state kind of has these metropolitan statistical areas, these kind of hot spots, if you will, of the economy. And the majority of economic output is happening in those. But Louisiana's are burn white hot. And then once you leave those, there's almost nothing. So we have 65 parishes within the state. 36 of them are contained within MSAs. There's nine of them. Actually, one of them might be leaving. One of them might be downgraded to a micropolitan, Alexandria. Sorry, Alexandria.
We do love Alexandria.
I'm sure we do. It's really just a function of population, though, and I'm not the one making that decision. Currently, right now, we have nine. Alexandria, you're hanging on there by a thread. So we have these nine, and they represent over 92% of output in the state. The other half of the parishes produce just right around 7%, seven and some change, of state output. And the employment numbers are almost perfectly lined up with that. So it's really kind of fascinating that we see half the state producing so little. And then when you dig even further, those silos, if you will, they truly are silos. They don't talk to one another. They don't have, economically speaking. So whatever is produced in Baton Rouge, the intermediate goods for that production aren't gathered from other MSAs locally in the area. They're gathered from outside of the state. Likewise, whatever they produce, they're producing for outside of the state. This has considerable effects on the economic impacts of things in the state. So basically, as soon as a dollar is spent in an economic zone, it immediately leaches out of the region of impact. So it doesn't have any recirculating effect, or very little recirculating effect. And so as a result, we don't gain the majority of economic benefit from these shocks that that happen to the state. And that's something that is going to take very careful policymaking in order to try to encourage some development of that. But right now, we're not seeing very careful policymaking in that regard. And so that's not getting any better.
So who is responsible for making those? Does that come at the state level?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, state legislature, not even at the governor's office. That's going to have to happen at the state legislature. But the state legislature is so fractured right now with these various micro coalitions, they're not getting anything done. Not that would address that. The kind of policy initiatives that we would need to address that, they're not happening. And so until that does happen, we're going to kind of slowly grow. We'll grow still, but we're going to grow at a slower rate compared to our neighbors, and definitely slower than, on average, than what we see for the rest of the country. If we just look at median income in the state, it's growing at like 0.8%. I mean, it's very small, and that's the long-run average. So we don't see a lot of robust growth happening. Whereas we see considerable robust happening at the national level. So we're not able to benefit from that. Now, and to kind of push back on that as well, usually when there's a shock, we don't see those negative shocks as much too. So we're kind of insulated from that. COVID aside, COVID's been bad for everything. I could talk for days just on what's happening right now.
What I hear in your answer is that the people of Louisiana, in order to move our economy forward, need to be cooperating, and they need to be working beyond industries, and they need to be working beyond boundaries, because these things are arbitrary, right?
Sure.
And I think to universities, can universities be leaders in those types of things?
They have
things?
To be.
Okay.
Yeah, they have to be here. Education is the only, it's the silver bullet. And there's very few concrete things that we can say about long-run growth theory in economics. I don't even do my research in long-run growth theory. I'm all about short-run movements and policy movements, and mostly on the monetary side of things. But when it comes to long-run growth theory, there's a whole bunch of conflicting results depending upon the various assumptions you build into your models, and they get outrageously, egregiously complex very, very quickly. But the underlying theme that keeps coming back is the only real investment that we can do in terms of our factors of production come from human capital, education. That's the only one that we see continual returns to scale from. Everything else kind of diminishes through time, but we don't see that when it comes to education. It is the silver bullet. But until we recognize that and start to kind of all work with that same baseline knowledge, we don't. I mean, right now in the state legislature, they were arguing just earlier this week on mandatory kindergarten.
So tell me about the next real report. I know that you and I have talked about what's coming out in the next real report. So what is it?
This is going to be the tech report, basically. So we've got two students that are really wanted to kind of dig into two happenings here at Tech. One of them works in admissions, so he's really interested in the impact of tours that we give. And so he's got some very interesting results that basically show that if we separate our students between those that have received campus tours versus those that haven't received mm-hmm. campus tours, those that have, because of their own self-selection and they're taking a little more vested interest in the decisions that they're trying to make and make an informed decision, they tend to have higher GPAs and higher ACT scores across every college, including undecided majors.
That is interesting.
So that has a really important policy implication. First, along the dimensions of, if you're going to roll out the red carpet, this is the group to do it for, because they're the ones that have the largest marginal impact on overall university numbers. But also at the same time, it kind of says, okay, well, we have an opportunity with those that don't get campus tours. Because if there's ever going to be, I mentioned FYE before, and the whole purpose of FYE is to kind of get students engaged in campus life right from the very beginning of their academic career, then as a result, it may be that it's really one group that might benefit from that relatively more than others. So it's an interesting application of looking at enrollment data. And then another student's interested in the recent buildings that are happening with campus dormitories, the kind of replacement. There's three different buildings that are or dorms that are getting rebuilt. Two of them will be ready in the fall. One, I haven't heard about the other one. There's a third one, and I'm not exactly sure when that one's going to be available.
I think not this fall, but next fall.
Yeah, probably within a year. But we're doing an economic impact study on those dorms, not only looking at the construction aspect of it, because they're a local builder, so that's kind of buoys things up as well. But then also at the same time, there's going to be kind of a premium to housing costs on that, and so there's going to be a net positive in terms of the amount, even though there's less heads that could stay in those dorms, there's still a net positive in terms of the number of room and board dollars that are being collected from that. And so examining that, and what is the impact on that happening just within Lincoln Parish and then the surrounding parishes that surround Lincoln Parish. And then I wanted to kind of supplement that, so I'm doing a small little two-page study on what is the economic impact of a single tech student. What do they do for the state? How much of that is localized to Lincoln Parish specifically? And I'll go ahead and give this number, I'll tease it a little bit. 85% of the economic benefit happens within Lincoln Parish.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's nearly a 3-to-1 for every dollar spent, it generates 3. And so that's really, really good. So that in terms of kind of return on investment for the local economy, that's great. So, yeah.
That is.
So this will be the tech report for sure.
That's good, though. that gives us things to talk about in our office. So that's a great thing. Well, Patrick, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate you being in here. And maybe we'll have you and your students back after the real report comes out, and we can talk about those things.
Okay? Anytime. Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. All right. I really appreciate that. It's been good.
Thank you.
Develop a prototype for the next big idea. Immerse yourself in the Internet of Things. Discuss with top CEOs the issues keeping them up at night. Manage a real investment portfolio. Pitch your best ideas to potential investors. Intern with Fortune 500 companies across the world or right next door. Do all of this and more as a student in Louisiana Tech's College of Business. Learn more about how you can leverage technology to its fullest and lead innovation in any organization at business.lawtech.edu.
Thank you for listening to Beyond 1894. Please subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about this episode, check out our show notes. Beyond 1894 is produced by Louisiana Tech University's Office of University Communications.